Good evening. Impeachment hearings begin. Is it the right reason to dump the president? A secret juvenile fingerprint database is exposed by legal aid lawyers and the Churros bust. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, November 13th, 2019. The New York City Police Department has announced the destruction of an apparently illegal database of fingerprints taken from underage New Yorkers. The cops had previously denied the existence of the juvenile fingerprint records, according to Legal Aid Society of New York. State law requires such records be destroyed after they are turned over to a group called the DCJS. The Director of Special Litigation and Law Reform at the Juvenile Rights Practice at the Legal Aid Society is Lisa Freeman.
The NYPD was appropriately fingerprinting youth, as far as we know, but under the law, under the Family Court Act, they are not permitted to retain those fingerprints. They're supposed to send them to the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services, DCJS, and they are not supposed to retain any copy of them. And DCJS is supposed to destroy the majority of those fingerprints, depending on the outcome of the arrest.
And that wasn't happening?
NYPD was transmitting the fingerprints, but they were maintaining their own unlawful database of these juvenile fingerprints.
How did you find out about this?
It took us quite a while to find this out. We began investigating this really in 2014 after we came across an individual client who was arrested based on fingerprints that the prosecutor acknowledged had been unlawfully retained. And we began investigating, trying to determine where the breakdown in the system was. We also saw a number of rap sheets that were filled with juvenile contacts that should not have been on their rap sheets. We began trying to confirm with the NYPD that, in fact, they had destroyed the children's fingerprints, as they were required to do after transmitting them to DCJS, and we were really met with resistance. We were repeatedly told that they had sealed the records when, in fact, they should have destroyed the fingerprints.
And what did you do next?
We persisted for quite some time. We met with them several times, and eventually we also were meeting with other players in the system, including DCJS, and DCJS did a review of their data and determined that, in fact, they had been wrongfully retaining thousands of juvenile fingerprints in their system as well, and they provided notification to NYPD and to other law enforcement agencies throughout the state that those local law enforcement agencies needed to destroy thousands of juvenile arrest-related records. We then pushed NYPD to find out if, in fact, they had done what DCJS had told them to do. And after about 9 months of resistance, we received an email from NYPD telling us that they had destroyed the fingerprints. And, in fact, they weren't supposed to have retained any of the fingerprints. When we got that admission, we knew for a fact that they had an unlawful fingerprint database.
Lisa Freeman is Director of Special Litigation and Law Reform of the Juvenile Rights Practice at the Legal Aid Society. A lawyer for Legal Aid, Christine Bella, says the scope of the NYPD's violation of the fingerprinting law is not fully known.
First of all, we know they've been fingerprinting juveniles as long as the law has allowed them to, and that dates back to the late 70s. So before the AFIS, which is the automated fingerprint identification system, which allows for the storing of digital and the transferring of digital prints, they would use fingerprint cards. So whether or not they were retaining the fingerprint cards of juveniles before transmitting them to the state, we can't say.
Could they be actually have those cards in files somewhere in a basement in a police station?
We did ask about the cards as well as a purge from AFIS, and we were told that all fingerprints have been destroyed, including the cards.
But they took a long time to do that. Why do you think that was?
That depends on your perspective, what type of intention you want to impute on the NYPD with regards to how they do business. We had no admissions with regard to their intent.
Are you sure they did it?
We were able to meet with them to discuss ways to for us to have the assurances that we think that we required to forego litigation. So I can't get into the particulars of it. I can tell you that they revised their practices and policy and issued a legal bulletin, as well as a Vinus memo, which I believe was distributed with our press release. So that went out to all members of service, and the legal bulletin was disseminated department-wide. And then we were able to get other assurances from them.
So you didn't have to go to a court or get a judge's order on any of this. They agreed to it.
Yes. The law was very clear and unequivocal with regard to what they were allowed to retain and what they were not allowed to retain.
What's the why is this important? What's wrong with having the fingerprints of kids on file? I mean, so what?
Yeah. So what? Well, first of all, it violates the law. Second of all, we believe the legislature thought carefully about why they would allow local law enforcement agencies to keep the prints of adults but not keep the prints of juveniles, because the juvenile system comes with a rehabilitative goal, and it's not a punitive system. The idea that when you're keeping data in an index and using it in perpetuity, it can lend itself to wrongful arrests, wrongful prosecutions, and we're talking mainly here about youth in New York City who are children of color, who come from some of the poorest communities in our five boroughs. So this is a group of youth that are marginalized, that are under greater surveillance by the NYPD, and whose fingerprints would then be retained and compared to prints going forward in perpetuity.
There's all this move afoot to collect DNA samples from everybody who's arrested. Does New York City do that, and is it required in the same way as fingerprints are?
Yes. So the requirements would be different, but that is something that we are looking very carefully at, both on the state level and on the city level. And that is why this story is, you know, also very important from a systemic point of view. We want the city council to step up and exercise its mandate, which is to exercise oversight over the NYPD and its surveillance practices, whether it involves fingerprints, facial recognition, DNA. The technology is ever expanding, and we can't sit back and simply trust that the NYPD will do the right thing with regard to people's individual privacy and civil liberties.
The cops raid a drug house, and they search for fingerprints, and they could find somebody who was a youth who had been there, maybe buying some pot or something. Next thing you know, they're kicking down their door, involving them in all of this. That's
right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you can be at a scene that it becomes a crime scene but was not when you were there. Mm-hmm. And the idea that your prints could be compared in perpetuity with the prints of those found at crime scenes is very troublesome.
Christine Bella is a lawyer for Legal Aid. Director Freeman says she supports a city council bill called the Public Oversight of Surveillance Technology, or POST Act, that requires the NYPD disclose basic information about the surveillance tools it uses and the safeguards in place to protect the privacy and civil liberties of New Yorkers.
What we're looking for is a city council hearing that really subjects the NYPD to close scrutiny, particularly in this time of ever-expanding surveillance. And the POST Act, which has been proposed, is one of the ways of accomplishing that, at least with regard to some surveillance techniques.
What's the POST Act?
The POST Act is reporting legislation with regard to the use of, I believe, facial recognition software. It involves the gang database as well.
An NYPD spokesperson, while not mentioning any database, said Wednesday the department destroys juvenile delinquent fingerprints after the prints have been transmitted to the Division of Criminal Justice Services. And in impeachment news, a top American diplomat revealed new evidence Wednesday of President Donald Trump's efforts to press Ukraine to investigate political rivals. The revelations came as House investigators launched public impeachment hearings for just the fourth time in the nation's history. William Taylor, the highest-ranking U.S. official in Ukraine, said for the first time that Trump was overheard asking another ambassador about the investigations. He'd urged Ukraine's leader to conduct one day earlier. Taylor said he learned of Trump's phone call with the ambassador only in recent days. It was all part of what Taylor called the irregular channel, a shadow foreign policy orchestrated by the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, outside traditional oversight. Republicans retorted that the Democrats still have no more than second and third hand knowledge of allegations that Trump held up millions of dollars in military aid for the Eastern European nation. GOP representatives have hammered at what they claimed was an unfair and politicized process aimed at undermining Trump's election. One refrain was that the aid to Ukraine at issue was eventually sent to the country struggling for control of its eastern provinces against a Russian-backed insurgency. But Texas Democrat Joaquin Castro grilled Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, neither of whom are lawyers, on the meaning of attempted criminal activity.
So he had a desperate man on the phone, and he asked a desperate man for a favor. And based on your testimony, it sounds like, begrudgingly, President Zelensky may have actually agreed to do that favor and investigate the Bidens and Burisma. Is that right?
President Zelensky does say in the transcript that he will pursue the investigations.
So we know that President Trump asked for a favor to help his political career, and it appears as though the president of the Ukraine agreed to that favor. Do we know why it didn't actually happen? Do we know why there was no announcement in front of CNN or to CNN about an investigation?
Mr. Castro, as we've determined, as we've discussed here, on September 11th, just before any CNN discussion or interview, the hold was released. The hold on the security systems was released.
But we don't. So the hold was released. Is it possible that the White House released that hold because they knew that a whistleblower had basically turned this in?
I don't know, sir.
Do you think that's possible?
I'm not in a position to judge.
So we have a president who the other side has claimed or has defended the president, saying that the aid went through, that there was never any investigation. But the president attempted to get those things done. And it looks like there was an initial agreement by the president of the Ukraine to actually do those things. So, ambassadors, is attempted murder a crime? Is attempted murder a crime?
Attempted murder is a crime.
Is attempted robbery a crime?
Neither of us is a lawyer, but
I think anybody in this room could answer that question.
I think that's right. I'll go out on a limb and say, yes, it is.
Is attempted extortion and bribery a crime?
I don't know, sir.
In the minute that I have left, I want you to speak to the nation about what's at stake, Ambassador Kent. You said in your opening statement, you warned about selective prosecutions and a president of the United States going after specific Americans abroad. If this Congress clears President Trump, does it mean that he can go ask another foreign country to investigate another presidential candidate, a member of Congress, a governor, a senator, or any private American citizen doing business overseas? If there's no consequence for a president who does that, then it means there's a green light, doesn't it, for any president to ask any country to go prosecute or investigate an American citizen for political and personal gain of that president. Doesn't it?
Thank you for the question. First of all, I'm not an ambassador.
I will repeat,
I think on principle, regardless of the country, whether it's Ukraine, the U.S., or any country, the facts of law, criminal nexus, should drive investigations by law enforcement officials, and it is not the role of politicians to be involved in directing the judicial systems of their own country or other countries.
And Trump himself was meeting in the White House with Turkey's President Erdogan. He said he had no time for what he termed TV lawyers.
Thank you. No, I didn't. I did not watch it. I'm too busy to watch it. It's a witch hunt. It's a hoax. I'm too busy to watch it. So I'm sure I'll get a report. There's nothing. I have not been briefed. No, there's nothing there. I see they're using lawyers that are television lawyers. They took some guys off television, you know. I'm not surprised to see it because Schiff can't do his own questions. Thank you very much, everybody.
But the Trump campaign did have time to release a political advertisement using ominous music and images of notorious communist flag burner Joey Johnson torching the American flag in Washington, D.C. earlier this year.
I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected.
He will get reelected.
we're going to impeach the
yeah! I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
The candidates are pulling the Democratic Party to the left.
You guys ready for a radical idea?
Call me a radical.
First thing I do is going to repeal this Trump tax cut.
As you say, the party is moving that way. Consider yourself a capitalist.
Democrats have given up on capitalism, looking towards socialism for the answers.
All the 2020 frontrunners have embraced radical ideas.
Let's eliminate all of that. Let's move on.
They're not willing to go to work, but they're going to get paid anyway. Well, that sounds like outright socialism.
Together, we will make America wealthy again. We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. And we will make America great again.
WBAI has been following the hearings. Here's a special report. Joining us in the studio is WBAI's own Jesse Lent, who has an analysis of today's impeachment hearings against President Donald J. Trump. Jesse, first impeachment hearings since the 1990s and President Clinton. What happened today that caught your attention the most?
First of all, hello, Paul. Great to be here. I think that you can see this as kind of a roadmap to what the different strategies are going to be. The Republicans are going to try to undermine the process. They are going to try to draw attention to the fact that this military aid for Ukraine at the heart of this issue, obviously the phone call where President Trump appeared to say he would only give Ukraine aid if they would look into Joe Biden's son Hunter. The Republicans are going to try to make the point that aid for Ukraine actually never happened until President Trump was in office, that President Obama, as they kept hammering home all day in the hearing, gave blankets to the Ukrainians instead of weapons. And after this story came to light, of course, the Trump administration released the aid to Ukraine. So again, they're going to attempt to say what is the problem here, as well as impugn the process, where the Democrats are going to attempt to lay out a systematic argument of why this is a problem, who thinks it's a problem, and where this diverges from American precedent in the past.
Do you think the Democrats were able to make their point or carry it home to the American people that these telephone calls made by the President of the United States to the President of Ukraine, seeming to benefit his own personal campaign, would reach the level of impeachable offense?
Well, that is the question, isn't it? Really, these hearings, as you said, the first publicly televised impeachment hearings in 30 years, with the goal of educating the public, trying to bring people who may still be on the fence onto their side. Most Washington reporters give the impression that Democrats in the House already have enough information, have seen enough in the testimony they've been doing behind closed doors to already impeach the president and send it over to the Senate. Adam Schiff, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, made the point that this is a chance for Americans to see these witnesses and hear them and judge for themselves how credible their testimony is.
So who testified today?
So today we had the acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, that is William B. Taylor Jr., testifying along with George Kent, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary at the State Department overseeing European and Eurasian affairs. Friday will be the former Ukraine ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch. These are two gentlemen, and one has to think that the choice, and again, getting back to Adam Schiff, the way these impeachment rules were written, the way that the House approved these measures, because there is no strict impeachment language on exactly how the House should proceed in an impeachment proceeding in the Constitution, each time it happens, it's left to the majority party to sort of reinvent exactly how the process will go. So the way that these hearings are structured, Adam Schiff has a tremendous amount of latitude on who to call, when different witnesses can be called. And this was a big point of contention among Republicans who were attempting to, at the beginning and end of the proceedings, in a way hijack the proceedings, make their own voices heard on who should be testifying, such as Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who, of course, sat on the board at Burisma, which is one of the things that Republicans are attempting to focus on. But getting back to Adam Schiff very quickly, one has to think that he made this decision to have these two men, both with sterling service records, that he chose to lead with them because these are the kind of people that have served Republican, Democratic administrations. If you're going to paint them as partisan figures, you're probably going to paint anyone that way.
A spokesperson for the activist group Refuse Fascism Out Now is Andy Z. He says the Democrats are impeaching Trump for all the wrong reasons.
These are the people on both sides there that are running such a largest empire in the history of humanity at great cost to the rest of humanity. That's one reason why they should care about what they say. It doesn't mean they should follow them. In fact, one of the things that these hearings actually highlight is the necessity for this not just to be contention, a sharpening contention between two sections of the ruling class, one of which is attempting to institute fascism, a whole different form of rule of the same system that's much more draconian, which means much more repressive, open terror, this kind of thing that you can see from Trump in his rallies and their policies. And the other side, the Democrats, who as a party are also a party who have committed war crimes and are war criminals. And in fact, the dispute here and what they've made the center of the impeachment proceedings from the Democrats' side is exactly over national security, including that the Democrats have tried to come at this, if you will, from the right, so to speak, in terms of our policy for prosecuting U.S. interests in the world is even more damaging. And Trump has hurt us in national security. These are not the terms to impeach, as much as it is important that he be and Pence be impeached from power because of what they're doing and the more dangerous course in an overall sense that they're taking for humanity.
What position should progressives take in regards to what's happening in Washington right now with these hearings?
I will speak here for Refuse Fascism first. And Refuse Fascism has said that the Democrats are not impeaching on the whole array of fascist outrages. The very things that concern listeners of WBAI and Pacifica more broadly, the child separation, the position towards immigrants, the climate, the Handmaid's Tale future, all these things, the danger of war in the Mideast, including the potential of nuclear, all these things he's not being impeached for. And the problem with that, even if they somehow succeed, which they could, getting articles of impeachment on the terms of national security and our elections being fair and square, even should they succeed on that terms, which is, I don't think, that likely, certainly in the Senate, it would legitimate the entire program. And so the thing we do have to do is, but people have to watch this to see how sharp the contention is, to see that what these Republicans are actually doing is delegitimizing the whole process, which, yes, from a perspective of what is humanity capable of, what does humanity need, is a political system that needs to be, and an economic system that needs to ultimately be overthrown. And that's something that I work on. But everybody, whether you believe in this system, whether you think it, have criticism of it, but think it could be made to work and the promise of America could be realized, everybody has an interest in what's going on in Washington to see the fascist core of the Republicans and the fact that the Democrats will not mount any resistance, and in fact, that they won't mount any resistance. They are mounting resistance, but that they are doing it on very narrow terms, and they've pretty much conceded that they're going to lose in the Senate. So we are calling for and Refuse Fascism, and as a revolutionary, I support this and help initiate it, that people need to get out in the streets in sustained mass non-violent protests every weekend. And this weekend, on November 16th, we are culminating the launch of this in protests around the country. I think there's about 15 cities now doing this, and here in New York at Union Square at 1 o'clock. And this is very important because there has to be a third force in all of this representing the interests of the people and not the interests of either side of this, although this fascist regime must be driven out of power. anybody with a heart for masses of people here and around the world with a concern for social justice has to understand that fascism is a tremendous danger for humanity and for any form of struggle for social justice. And then from my perspective, and we have to go forward from there after driving this out, and in the course of driving it out, build up the forces for what? For an actual revolution. Now, people may, and many people working with Refuse Fascism, have other political objectives, and that is as it should be, because this is an existential danger, meaning this is a life and death situation for humanity with this fascist regime.
Andy Z is an activist and spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, as well as the group Refuse Fascism, out now. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, November 13th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jesse Lent. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of the independent, local, and listener-sponsored WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.